Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another great episode we have for Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb, and this is going to be our Thanksgiving show since we're not going to have one next weekend for the holidays. We've got a great show for you today. Exciting times here with John Weissman. Coming up first here, we got AJ Scuderi, and then we're going to finish off with Stephen Brayton. Three great authors and three, probably, I guess you want to say, totally different genres of the suspense mystery thriller zone. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy, because an hour and a half of Suspense Radio begins right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
We want to thank everybody for joining us this morning here. It's going to be a great show. We have a lot of great things to talk about with Kindle Fire, the Barnes & Noble new Nook now, with the announcement of Penguin and their self-publishing, along with our Best of 2011 list that's coming out. So we got a lot of things to go over. But first, we're going to jump right in here to our first guest, whose latest book is called KBL, Kale Bin Laden, a novel based on true events, a subject that all Americans, of course, love to hear about that, you know, with the death of bin Laden. I mean, of course, you're celebrating death, which is a little bit kind of a morbid thing, but when you're talking about Osama bin Laden, I really don't think anybody's going to shed a tear for him. So I want to bring on our first guest and the author of that book, John Weissman. John, thank you so much for joining us, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. It's great to be with you.
So, KBL, Kale Bin Laden, just came out here, I believe, on the 15th of November. You've been getting some stellar reviews because of the trueness of your writing about the events that go on within the book. So can you kind of tell everybody, you know, a little bit about the, you know, conception of it and the things that you put in there and why you decided to write a book like this?
Sure. Well, I decided to write it in fiction because it's impossible to write this story in nonfiction these days. Nobody's talking. The SEALs aren't talking. The CIA isn't talking. The Pakistanis aren't talking. And Osama bin Laden isn't talking. I was approached by HarperCollins shortly after the Abbottabad mission. And they said, can you do us a nonfiction book? And I spent a day or so thinking about it and calling around, dealing with some sources, and the answer to them was no. If I told you I could do it in nonfiction, I'd be a liar, because with nobody talking, you can't have source notes, you can't have reporting notes, you can't have footnotes. It would just be impossible. So what I suggested to them was, let me report this as if I were writing nonfiction, but then let me create a parallel universe so that, for example, if the head of U.S. SOCOM or the head of the Joint Special Operations Command is in a two-way conversation with the commander of SEAL Team 6, neither of those people can be interviewed on. They're just not talking. They don't want information out. But if
right.
you could figure out pretty much what they are saying and are writing it as fiction and not using their names but other names, you can write the dialogue, and it'll sound absolutely true. And I think, John, this is one of the cases, I mean, I think KBL is one of the cases where you can get at the truth better in fiction than you can in nonfiction.
Absolutely. And, you know, you couldn't get anybody to talk even off the record to say, hey, I'll give you a snippet, but you can't use my name, you can't use anything, you know, nothing to that effect, which in today's day and age, it's kind of, you know, very different when you find someone that doesn't want to talk about it at all. You would think that, you know, at least somebody would maybe say something, like I said, off the record.
Well, here's the problem. The people who were on this raid have all signed papers, you know. They all have top secret clearances. If they are caught talking to a reporter, they're not SEALs anymore.
Right.
They lose their careers. And certainly nobody at the agency is talking. I was told, I think, strongly sourced, that Leon Panetta, who was at that point head of the CIA, now he's the defense secretary, said at the time of the mission, if there are any leaks from this place and I catch who it is, that person will not have a job at the end of the day.
And probably go to jail.
Well, you know, all this stuff is classified. So what I did was I worked in open source, kind of OSINT, as they call it in the trade, and also talked to a lot of people at a lot of Tier 1 units who do these same sorts of raids hundreds of times a year. I mean, the template for the Bin Laden raid was nothing special. There were 1,700 of these high-value target raids done in Afghanistan last year. So the tactics were not special. What was special about this was, A, the target, and, B, the fact that we're going 150, 160 miles deep into Pakistan to do it.
Right. And then we had the news of the tragic news of what happened to SEAL Team 6 in the helicopter accident. And, I mean, we're just talking of just a humongous wave switch of emotion from what they did with Bin Laden and then all of a sudden what happened to them. I mean, did that take into account anything when you wrote the book here, Kill Bin Laden? When that happened, did you move anything around? Did anything else happen to the effect? Or, you know, how did that make you feel when you were, you know, getting into all those?
First of all, I think I should clarify for you. The SEALs that got hit on that CH-47 were not the same SEALs that went after Bin Laden. SEAL Team 6 or DEVGRU, whatever you want to call it these days, it's got a classified name that I know, but I'm not going to say, certainly on the radio. Well, these were not the same SEALs. There are lots of SEALs in Afghanistan, and they're doing lots of missions all the time. And I think I was very reliably informed that, it was Red Squadron that was used on the Bin Laden hit, and these were SEALs from Gold Squadron.
And that's something that the normally American people don't know about, those types of things. And it's probably good that we don't know everything. I think it's always a good thing that we don't know everything. That's just my thought. So that's good for clarification on that, because I had no idea.
Yeah, it was a different group, and the other part of it is that I also have been told, and I've got to take it on face value, that it was a lucky shot. I mean, this was not something that the Taliban had or the Haqqanis or whoever had put together and gathered intelligence and tracked these guys and done all of that. It was a lucky shot. It went through the windshield of the chopper and it killed the pilot. The helicopter flipped and crashed, and lots of good lives were lost.
Now, and getting back here, and we're speaking to everybody with author John Weissman, and he just wrote the book KBL, which is Kill Bin Laden. It's a novel, of course, based on true events, like John has just said, that you can never write anything totally nonfiction with a subject matter like this because, you know, you're just not going to be able you just can't know all everything, and that's one of the things that you just can't know. But when you were writing this, and you had to think of this, cause like you said, you know, pretty quick, I mean, this just happened, you know, not too long ago, so you didn't have a lot of time to really, you know, get yourself in. You kind of had to go, you know, kind of maybe on the fly. You know, was that kind of an easier thing that you've done since, you know, with your past books, or was it a lot more difficult writing this, knowing that you had to do things that was a little bit more of a quicker pace with you writing them?
Well, this thing was a real sprint. It was 71 days of nonstop work because you're researching and writing at the same time.
Yeah.
But it flowed, I think, very well, and I had a huge amount of help from people in the community, the intelligence community and the special operations community, who would look at chunks of this thing and point me in the right direction. I've been writing about this stuff for 20 plus years.
Right.
And so you develop some really great friends in low places. And I think I was able to develop a lot of really good information that that parallels the real stuff that will be declassified in 10 or 15 or 20 years, or at least some of it will. And also, I was able to do in the epilogue a look at the burial that is exclusive to me. I have not seen anything on the burial at sea that comes close to the information I was given.
And so that's something that you were able to share in a non-fictional way, like you said in the epilogue of the book, which is, that's an extremely powerful event in, you know, world history that we've experienced here, which not everyone can, you know, I mean, it's very, like I said, I mean, it touched everybody. It touched a nation and a world, basically, when the announcement came out that he had died.
Absolutely. And that is why there was such interest in doing this and trying to report as much as I could about the real stuff that was going on. And I do think, I mean, when I hear from people in the community that KBL is spot on in some of its areas, you're looking and saying, well, okay, the reporting worked. I mean, it is, it's good to be able to do a novel and still maintain the same sort of journalistic procedures of, you know, talking to people, talking to sources who are helpful, because you are writing a novel which will give my sources deniability. Mm-hmm. It's not as if they're giving me the crown jewels. It's that they are helping a writer of fiction write more accurately and more balanced. Because that, as you know, was one of the huge problems in the early days after the operation. Every single story was spun a different way because politically the White House had certain goals that it had to achieve. The National Security Staff had certain things it wanted to get out. People up on Capitol Hill wanted to make themselves more important and more allegedly knowledgeable than they were. And so a lot of false information was disseminated over that first week, week and a half. And you go in and say, wait a second, that doesn't sound right, you know?
Right. Now, and just to let people know, I mean, this is not, you know, you have a couple, you know, you have a lot more books here that you've written as far as with the political, going back to, you know, Direct Action and Jack in the Box, which both also came out by HarperCollins. And now that you, you know, have written, you know, the Kill Bin Laden, would you say that this book, it was probably on an emotional level, probably at the highest that you've done so far in your plus 20 years of writing these political CIA thrillers?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a high point for me, because what I got to do in Kill Bin Laden was pay tribute to the warriors who were both in and out of uniform. I mean, I'm not just talking about the guys on SEAL teams or Delta Force or Army Rangers. I'm talking about the people who set up that safe house in Abbottabad, who have incredible guts because they're working without a net. And to the people who pushed this when the White House and the Pentagon were saying, you know, let's play it safe. And to the analysts who finally, after 10 years, connected the dots. And to the head of the CIA, Leon Panetta, who pushed it at the White House and stood in the door when the Attorney General came and tried to indict his interrogators and said, no, you won't, not on my watch. It's wonderful to write about something that worked, you know. I mean,
right.
you've read Direct Action and you've read Jack in the Box, and what those books are about is the dysfunction that was rife at the CIA in the 90s in the first few years of this decade. But it would seem that some of that has gone away now. And certainly the intelligence community had a great success with this particular operation. And, by the way, with other operations, because they have degraded al-Qaeda tremendously over the past 2 or 3 years. And that is something also I get to in KBL.
You know, and the New York Times, and just so people know, because this is a subject matter that, you know, like we've mentioned, you know, you're never going to know the true story. But the New York Times put it probably best, I would say, in the praise here for KBL, Kill Bin Laden, is they say, you know, we will probably never get the full true account of how Bin Laden was found and killed. But this book and the novelization of the mission that you write is the next best thing. How did that make you feel, knowing that this was probably in the last, you know, because we never killed Hitler. I mean, he was dead, but there was never anything, you know, like this kind of raid. And Saddam Hussein was something that was totally different in the raid also. How did it make you feel to know that, I would say, arguably in the last, you know, 100 years, that this guy was probably the most sought-after villain from the United States, and you were the one that got to write about it and to hear that praise?
Well, it made me feel real good, I will tell you. And I think that because this book, I felt emotionally very much involved in writing it. This is a villain of historic proportions. This is a man whose vision of life was entirely negative. This is a fellow to whom human life was cheap. I mean, jihadists as a group idolized death as opposed to life, and so he got what he deserved. But to be able to write it not just about that, but about the American heroes who got him, I am hugely proud that one of the two central characters in this book is a double amputee retired Army Ranger. Because I think if you talk to wounded warriors, they don't want our pity. All they want is to be able to go back to work.
Right.
I was at the Naval Academy 2 weekends ago and met one of our wonderful wounded warriors who was less than a month from losing his leg in Afghanistan. And all he wanted to do, this Marine, was to get back to his unit and go operational again. Now, that kind of dedication, you know, you look at the Occupy people and you look at these guys and you say, who do I want to write about?
Exactly. You know, who are the real heroes? I mean, especially with the holiday season coming up and family, you know, so prominent. I mean, this is not only a book, you know, and I think you might agree, this is not only a book of a mission, but it is a book of, like I said, like deep emotion of the people involved with the mission. And so you were great at being able to capture that whole ball instead of just, you know, writing, I guess, you know, a straightforward thriller about how they went in, got killed, boom, done. You know, you put the emotional spin on the people, on, you know, how this affects them also before, kind of after, during the whole thing.
You know, if I tried to do one thing in this book, and I think I achieved it, it's to capture the passion with which some of these people approach their work, whether it's Charlie Becker on the ground by himself in Abbottabad, whether it is the people in the safe house, whether it is the director of the CIA, whether it's a young SEAL who is fighting to keep his job and then gets a second chance and ends up going on this mission. To the pilots who fly them, to the people who support them, I tried very, very hard to distill that passion and bring it out so that readers will say, "Oh yeah, that's what our guys are doing, and our guys and our women are doing."
Now, I want to also say that there is an event that people can go and they can meet you. Thursday, December 15th, I don't have the time, but you're going to be at the International Spy Museum there in Washington, D.C., and, of course, you're going to be promoting, you know, the book. You know, tell a little bit about, you know, what that event is going to be like for you on December 15th there.
Well, it's going to be super because the Spy Museum is a terrific venue, and it happens to be one of Washington's main tourist attractions. And so you get a lovely cross-section of folks there, and there are a lot of former retired spooks who show up from time to time, and I think it's going to be a great, great venue. I certainly have fun at book signings because I love to meet readers. I love to meet people who will talk to me about books they like or even books they don't like.
And this is a great way to kind of meet, you know, the people and go out there and, yeah, and you're able to, you know, when you write a book like this, it's just great to be able to talk to everybody, and especially, like you said, the International Spy Museum is probably one of the best places to do that at. And, of course, you know, what can we expect coming up here in the future? Are you working on something else?
I am, actually. I am putting together the outline of a new Charlie Becker novel because I love the character, and I like the idea of writing what could be called a kind of literary psychological action adventure thriller about a double amputee. Because you've read the book, and nothing holds him back. And
that,
by the way, is the way it is with these guys. So I'm not, you know, I'm not gilding the lily here. I'm not stretching what these folks have done and are doing and will do in the future. I mean, Charlie Becker lost both legs in Iraq. He thinks the rest of the world is disabled.
Right, and that's the way those guys actually, and that's the way they think. That is
mm-hmm.
the way that they think.
Absolutely.
So, well, I'll tell you what, John, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Very powerful here with your book, KVL, Kill Bin Laden. Perfect time coming out here for the holidays, and with all the new Kindle Fire and, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble Nook, along with the hard copy, people can get it. And I want to thank you so much for joining us. And please email us when you have your website up so we can get that out so people can have a good way of, you know, maybe getting in contact with you. Right now, you can go to the HarperCollins.com page and find, you know, John Weissman and look at your biography that way. So thank you so much again, John, for coming on with us.
John, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. You have a good day.
You too. Be safe.
Okay. So again, everybody, that was author John Weissman. He wrote the book KBL, Kill Bin Laden. a novel based on true events in a fictional setting, but like the New York Times said, you know, you're not going to get anything closer to what really happened than reading here, you know, his book, Kill Bin Laden. So I want to thank John for coming on here. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest, A.J. Scuderi. We're going to have a little news and notes for you all. So we will see you right back after this because, quite frankly, I'm kind of thirsty. So be right back at you. Welcome back here with Little Sandy Ballet. Like I said, I need to get something to drink, so I thought I'd leave you with a little True. we are joined here again and with our next guest, AJ Scuderi. She wrote a book. It's called God's Eye. You can find her at ajscuderi.com. That's S-C-U-D-I-E-R-E. So, AJ, I want to thank you so much for joining us, and how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. This is fantastic.
Hey, thank you so much for coming on with us. We appreciate it, especially here with your new book, God's Eye. So can you kind of tell a little bit about, you know, the book? I see that you're going to be doing a ton of events in 2012, checking out your website, which I think is incredible because a lot of authors are not going out to the masses as much as, like, what you're going to do. So, you know, it's a great thing. And God's Eye, you know, give us a little bit about it.
Well, God's Eye is a twist on a classic tale. Catherine, the main character, is just living the life that worked out for her. And I think a lot of us do that to a certain extent, you know. We follow along as things make sense and do what's in front of us. But because of this, because she's so malleable, she's targeted by a demon. And once the demon targets her, an angel comes and tries to save her, and they both appear to her as humans. And it takes her a while to figure out exactly what's going on with these strange new people in her life. And once she figures out she's got one demon and one angel, and she's going to have to make a choice, she realizes she can't tell which one's which.
So, not really a Jiminy Cricket, but kind of like that, because you kind of got... you kind of get a couple, you know, kind of things going on when you're talking. You know, you get the CIA, you know, the agent like that. But then you kind of have, you know, the fantasy part with, you know, the angel demon kind of coming in. How was it to kind of mix those things kind of together? Because it's a little bit different.
Well, it's definitely a different story. I think the hardest part of writing it was that I always knew who was who, and I want it to be a very different book when you read it the second time. You know, once you get through to the end the first time and you find out, you know, what really was going on all along and who was what and why they said what they did, that if you go back and read it again, it'll be quite a different view on it because of what you already know. But when I wrote it already knowing who's the demon, who's the angel. And I wanted to be sure there were enough clues so that at the end you could say, yeah, I should have seen that, but not enough that you figured it out too early.
And like you said, you know, it's definitely an original, you know, story when, you know, there's a lot of thrillers out there that are just kind of straightforward and, you know, it's kind of tough to sift through. But you, in turn, were able to write something that not only is it a great suspense thriller, but it is. It's just a different... kind of a little different twist with, you know, some mystery and intrigue thrown in there. And it must have been fun to write.
It was fantastically fun to write. I'm a writer who writes beginning to end. I know other people don't, but I do. And I also don't write out an outline ahead of time. It's all in my head. But as I get closer and closer to the end, I start writing more and more things down, things that, you know, they've been lingering there for a while and need to be included. But the end, I think, is a big deal. It should be artfully done, and I think a lot of authors don't pay enough attention to that. And so as I got toward the end, I wound up with a ripped half of a legal sheet, three Post-it notes, and a napkin that had all these scribblings on with various arrows heading different directions, and I've been threatening to frame it. So, just
wow.
Tied up. Yeah.
You say you don't write outline, and a lot of authors, you know, it's funny because when you hear, you know, when you go up through, you know, through school and English class and this and that, it's like, you got to write outline, got to write outline. And then when you start talking to a lot of authors, it's like, yeah, I don't really go the outline route. But do you kind of write from the back forward? Do you already know the ending and you kind of have to start your way forward, or do you just kind of do it kind of pieces and parts within your head and then you kind of mix that puzzle all together to get it to flow right?
I definitely do it from the pieces and parts in my head. When I started Resonance, my first book, I knew the beginning. I knew exactly what was going on at the beginning, and I knew it was going to happen halfway through. And as I got closer to the end, I figured out what the end was going to be. With God's Eye, which is my third book,
yep.
I knew the end before I knew the rest of it. And in fact, I wrote 7 chapters of it in my first draft and then scrapped it and started over. I changed Catherine's profession. I changed where the story starts, what the viewpoints you were allowed were. All of it changed after chapter 7. I was like, no, I have to go back and do it differently. So each book has been a slightly different process. And I have to say, the fourth book that I'm writing now I definitely learn as I go, and I definitely use what I learn, but it's a fourth process. It's not the same process again.
Right. And now, can we expect, and I guess, you know, when you're writing a character that you're having so much fun with, and, you know, Catherine in this setting is, you know, it's a standalone, can you envision her moving forward? Are you going to move her forward, or have you not kind of worried about that yet in the future where you know, with the writing?
I haven't worried about that yet. Like you were asking, I think I have a bunch of different pieces in my head, and they come together and they plug into different stories. So I'm working on book number 4 right now, and I have outlines in my head through book number 10. And
Through 10?
Yeah, there's some serious craziness bouncing around inside my skull.
You know what you need? You need a flash drive inserted in your ear to pull that out so you don't forget it.
That would be so nice. That would be so awesome. No, they're registered with the Writers Guild, and that's about as far as a lot of them have gotten. But as I think of things, I really do file them in my head in different places. One of the books, and this one it's a much future book, but it would be part of a series. But I was trying to figure out how to make werewolves physiologically possible. And my poor sister, I jumped up and down one day and I was like, I got it. I think I got it. And she said, which book is it for? And I said, number 9?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Hang on to it for a while then.
With your book here, God's Eye, and, you know, this is your fourth one. Do you think that you've kind of hit your stride? Did you hit it maybe before? Are you maybe still, you know, because, you know, every author, when they always say, you know, they always have to strive to get better and to get better and to get better. And some of them just kind of hit a stride early where you just know it's like, you know, they're just going to take off because they've kind of hit it. Do you feel in your mind, not from what your fans say, that you've hit your stride, that you've hit it?
I think I am. I think that's a fantastic question. It requires a bit of thought. When I started out, you know, much younger, having told myself I would be published. You know, that's what I wanted to do. And I continually started books and didn't finish them. I have 180 pages of a book that I just dropped partway through.
Wow.
And so when I really buckled down, my first order of business was to finish. And so that book is never going to see the light of day.
Yeah.
And so the second one I wrote to be better. I wrote to make my college writing professor proud and do, you know, all the things that he had told me if I pushed myself, I would become better at. And so by the time I wrote Resonance, I was really already starting to pick up speed. And so I think, yeah, at this point, I've been getting better as I go, and I think I still am. I don't want that to change, and I don't want to get into a place where anybody ever picks up one of my books and says, you know, the characters are kind of new and the names are new, but I feel like I've read this before.
So when you start with a book, like you said, 180 pages, and you just drop it, and then you decide to move forward, and then you're like, okay, now this is what I, you know, you said to get your college professor, and this is what, you know, I want to do. How did you kind of come up with the fact of these first 180 pages are crap, and they're never going to go anywhere, to where you're like, now I kind of hit it. Was it a light that clicked on? Did you do more reading? You know, a lot of authors like to know because they get stuck in that rut of those 180 pages that you have. And I think some of them quit, and I think that that's a shame.
It is. I think a lot of us that when you are of a creative mind where you write and you have a story you want to tell, it's easy when you get stuck to just start doing something else. And so that was a big challenge to overcome for me. And a lot of people have that, just like you said. I think the other thing is too many people try to write the great American novel simply by sitting down and typing. And I did that too. I thought I'm writing a book. And mm-hmm. I have a history as a teacher. And one of the things I've learned, you know, through my college degrees with neurophysiology and all that, is that you can't do 15 things at once. And that if you try to do them, you'll never see improvement in any of them because there's too many things that are changing. And so I did something that I think not enough people do, which is I gave myself a singular goal. And, you know, if I did other things well, you know, I had a couple other things I wanted to do along the way, but with that first one, the one that's never going to get published, my only goal was finish. You know, second, I wanted there to be a good plot. I wanted the characters to be relatable. But if those things didn't happen, that was okay because I just wanted to finish. And so then when I went and wrote the second one, I already knew I could finish. So finish was kind of one of those things that was already on the table. And the next thing that needed to come was that the writing was really solid writing, that it had, you know, had some literary quality to it, that the writing alone was pleasant to read, interesting wording, you know. And so I think that's something that a lot of people who are writing need to understand, is that, you know, we're trying to create this masterpiece, but you don't do it in a single stroke.
Ah, gotcha. And when you meet people, I'm always intrigued by this, because I don't know if you ever saw the movie Back to School, where Rodney Dangerfield wrote a paper, or he didn't, but a paper on Kurt Vonnegut, and the English teacher says, you know, I don't know who wrote this, but they don't know a thing about Kurt Vonnegut, when Kurt Vonnegut wrote his own paper for Rodney Dangerfield. When you go out into the masses, and I preface it by saying, so when you go out there and people come up and they talk to you about your book, do you ever hear something from them like, wow, they totally missed the boat on this one? And then on the flip side, it's like, wow, this person actually really got it. Do you hear those types of things? And then if you do hear something that's incorrect, you kind of correct them and say, yeah, it wasn't really like that. You kind of missed the boat on that one.
I've had the occasional missed boat. But I'm happy that it's been very few and far between. But, yeah, every now and then I get somebody who really, really gets it. And that is so much fun. Because when I write, before I sat down to write Resonance, you know, and I had written a couple by then, so I had a handful of things that I needed to accomplish, you know. And one of those things, aside from, you know, having the writing be solid and the story be good, I wanted the book to have several layers to it. I wanted you to be able to take it to the beach and sit down and keep turning pages and at the end go, that was fun. And I wanted you to be able to take it to your book club and have a good discussion about it. You know, I've always enjoyed the idea of Margaret Atwood's Handmaid Tale. The handmaid in that book is named of Fred, and it's described about how the handmaids are named for the person they belong to. There's of John and of Fred. But the handmaids wear red, and her name of Fred is also off red. And I always wonder if Margaret Atwood knew that, or if it was just strictly coincidental that it had come out that way. And so I've written a lot of things like that into my book. And I do get fans who come up and say, hey, you know, I was reading God's Eye, and I saw this character of Margot there, and she fits the old mythology of demons and the shaman. And I said, yeah, she does.
Yeah.
And if you Google the characters' names from the book or look up the meanings of the names or the places that they go, they add another layer to the story. There's always a deeper question. So, yeah, you can read Vengeance as an action book and the assassins are after the bad guys. But if you look at it a little bit deeper, you know, if you want, it asks the question of, you know, what does it mean to be right and what does it cost you to be right? And if you read God's Eye on it, you know, if you want, look at it a little deeper level, it brings up that key idea of, you know, yes, some evil is obvious, but a lot of it isn't. And would you know it if you saw it?
Interesting. And I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with AJ Scuderi. Her website is AJSCUDIERE. We're speaking about the book here, God's Eye, but along with everything else that you've written, like you just mentioned, Vengeance, you have Renaissance, and you can everybody can find out, you know, about your website here, along with if they want to email you, they can email you, which is very noble of you to be able to get emails like that right on your website. A lot of authors are taking that down.
I love it. I actually love it.
But that's, and, you know, and then when, you know, the other thing that they can find out is here is if they go to where you're going to be, because you're going to be out there. You said, you know, you're going to Comic-Con, which is a huge place here in 2012, along with a bunch of other places. What made you decide to kind of do, I guess you want to say, this kind of huge kind of events, which is different from a lot of authors. Instead of going to little bookstores, you're going to huge events.
Yeah, it really has to do with the publisher as well. The publisher has, one of the things I really liked about Griffin Inc., though they're smaller, they're very much behind their authors, and they believe that the author's vision is the right vision, which is not necessarily true of a lot of bigger houses. I mean, you lose a lot of rights to your book, you can get shelves in a different category than what you had written it for, and that can be problematic. But the thing that I thought was so innovative about Griffin Inc. is that they know the fiction market is changing. I mean, you look at a Kindle or a Nook or an iPad, and fiction isn't hardback, and six months later you get a paperback. That's not what it is anymore. And so they're really looking to branch out and put fiction into a whole bunch of new people's hands in a whole bunch of new ways. And so they've done that. Yeah, in the same way a lot of other publishers have, by being on every e-format possible and being, you know, available in whatever format you want to get it. But they've gone further with audio movies. So the audiobooks have a full cast and a soundtrack and sound effects, and the production company that does those is just unbelievably amazing. And they've been out winning awards. And one of the other things is, you know, going out and hitting a lot of these big convention. So it's a combination of book fairs and cons. So yeah, we've been at Dragon Con for 2 years now. We'll be back this year at Comic Con in July. And it really is about the fact that these are really, really neat stories, and you can have them delivered to you however you wish.
And so, you know, the good thing is that, you know, you're embracing the technology change of what's going on in publishing. You know, you went around, you know, you're not an old author like, you know, back when, you know, people are 50, 60 years old still writing, and they saw, you know, they've seen it from, you know, way back when until now, and, you know, their head kind of spin. But you kind of jumped on this here right when everything was kind of turning around and moving. But, you know, how does it change from day to day with the technology and everything that you have to do as an author? Because getting your name out there is a lot more difficult than it was 20 years ago when the book publishers could basically say, this is all we're going to put out, and this is all you had to choose from. But now you have to fight for everything, because there's over 1 million copies just available on Amazon Kindle. So how do you kind of overcome those things?
You keep going out there, and it definitely is crazy. You're right about that. I happen to embrace crazy completely with open arms. But I keep up with a handful of things, and a lot of it is things I wish I had had. So, and it's different outlets for me as well. So it's not just an issue of reaching out, but it's a nice way to let other things happen that don't happen in the books. You know, the books are thrillers. And so I have a blog called Smart Chickens that's just full of snarky everyday irony. And I have a second blog following the fourth book, and that's full of things I wish I had known before I got started, before I wrote my query letters and started talking to agents, you know, things that really helped me. And it also follows the fourth book from idea. I mean, started back in January, and I really just started writing pen to paper a couple of weeks ago for the fourth book. And so, you know, it chronicles everything that goes into it. You know, all the times I sat and just, you know, kind of went down in my room and pulled the covers over my head and say, okay, what's going to happen next in the story? And is that feasible? And all the time I spent calling fire departments and seeing who would let me come and do a ride-along and then going and doing that research. So all the various pieces that went into it, along with the, again, the tips, the things I wish I'd known.
You know, and are you a member of ITW?
Yes. Yes, I am. I was actually a guest author on their blog last month.
And like you mentioned, you know, those things, I think, for authors coming up are extremely important to make sure that they get involved with and get into. I see you're not going to Thriller Fest in 2012, because it looks like Comic-Con is going to override that. And But, you know, that's one of those places, and I don't know why Comic-Con is so early. It's never in the middle of July. It's always at the end, so I don't know what they're doing
there.
But... you know, that's just another one of those events that I think authors, you know, need to embrace and go to those places like that to just keep helping themselves and getting themselves out there, without a doubt.
Absolutely. I think, you know, writing to a very large extent is something that does and needs to happen in a vacuum. And so every chance you get to go out and put yourself out in the world and think about what you're doing. I mean, if you want to be published, you have to convince somebody that you deserve it and that your book has a spot on the shelf that's not a spot that already exists, but it's close enough to a spot that already exists that you're not so bizarre that there's no place for you.
Right.
And, yeah, I think getting out to those conventions and taking classes and finding beta readers is so, so important. And I think the thing I learned that I don't think enough people do is that classes are worthwhile. But my recommendation is that aspiring writers take a writing class in a genre that they don't write.
To give them that different perspective, yeah.
It does. It makes your writing more unique. So I always knew I was going to write novels. I never had any intention of writing prose poetry. But one of my favorite professors in college caught a writing piece of mine and demanded that I join his prose poetry course. And I fought him tooth and nail. I was like, I'm not going to write prose poetry. Why would I do this? And I stayed in his course for 3 semesters because it was so, so good for me. And it's easier to listen to what you need to listen to, the criticisms. I think it's really hard to hear. I think if I had handed in a novel and my classmates had torn it apart, I would have walked out in tears. But I was able to really listen because it was prose poetry. Because I was like, well, I don't write prose poetry. It's okay if you don't like it. And I learned so much more because I was open. And with it being a shorter form than I was used to writing as well, I think, you know, I learned a lot about, you know, those essential elements of what goes into a story or a snapshot of something. And it improved my writing hundreds of percent. I mean, there's no measure for it.
I'll tell you, great stuff, AJ. Thanks so much for coming on.
One thing I wanted to mention. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, please.
You can get to the website at godseyethebook.com, which is much easier to spell than my name.
Oh, okay. So God's Eye, the God's Eye?
Or just God's Eye, the Book.
God's Eye. The book. God's Eye, the book.com. Mm-hmm. So, and then you kind of link it all together, and that's fabulous.
Exactly, because Scuderia is incredibly hard to spell.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not incredibly hard to say, and I got it right the first time, which is just a major accomplishment for me, and I have to pat myself on the back. So.
You should. It's a major accomplishment for me. Nobody says it right the first time.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, AJ, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Great stuff today. I mean, the book is God's Eye, and people need to go out and pick it up. Like I said, perfect time for the holidays. you got all those Kindle Fires and those new Nooks coming out, and you know, potential of, you know, a little over 7 million of those things sold. So that's a lot of people to buy books.
Excellent. Yeah, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure.
Hey, thank you so much, AJ. You have a great day. Keep us up to date, and you know, let us know what's coming on with the next one, and we will stay in touch.
Cool. Thank you. Bye.
All right. Have a good day. Okay, again, everybody, that was AJ Scuderi. You can find her at ajscuderi.com or godseyethebook.com for her book, God's Eye, which is, like I said, it's a different kind of twist. It encompasses a couple genres put together, and it's definitely something that you need, that you know, you should go and check out. You know, check out what you think about it and, you know, decide whether or not, you know, you want to get it. But it's definitely something that, you know, we would recommend. Well, I'll tell you what, we are going to take another short break here. We're going to be back with our last guest coming on, and then we're going to have a little news notes. Like I said, we're going to talk about Penguin going into self-publishing. Good, bad, and different. What do you think? Is it going to be the first big mistake? Who knows? Kindle Fire shipped on the 15th of November, and Barnes & Noble's coming out with their new tablet to challenge Amazon. Good idea, bad idea? What's the differences between the two? Find out here when we come back, and we will see you in about 3 minutes.
Thank you.
you know, you can call me a geek or whatnot, but I've been sitting here for the last 30 seconds just, you know, kind of mouthing the song Into the Night here by Benny Mardoons. Kind of, you know, kind of a little somber. It's a little cloudy outside today in Los Angeles. It's going to be a little cold. So I kind of picked a little bit of different music, like I said, with Spandau Ballet and now Benny Mardoons. But, hey, you can't go wrong. I mean, let's face it. But I want to bring on here our next guest. Stephen Brayton is the author of a new book called Beta. It's the first book in his latest series for Mallory Peterson. So, Stephen, I want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing great. You
so
said
like
it was
said,
a little cloudy out there. It's I'm here in Iowa, and it's cloudy and about 53.
Ah, see? And so we're not going to be too far off. We're actually going to have rain. We're in Los Angeles in the wintertime. It does kind of happen, but still wouldn't rather live anyplace else than L.A. Got to be truthful on that one. Even though I can take the traffic and I can take all the people because the weather is just so perfect. So, but the new book, Beta, your first crack here at a new series with Mallory Peterson, with the next book, like you said, on your website, which is StephenBrayton.com. Stephen is PH. With your next book, Alpha, coming out in 2012. Tell us a little bit about Beta, and you know, starting out, coming off the gate with a brand new character, it's got to be an exciting time.
Well, yeah, I've really started this character a long time ago, and I already had one book out, Night Shadows, and that can also be found on the website. But this one I had written before Night Shadows, and I had actually started out with Alpha, which, like you said, is coming out next year. But after I had it completed, I went to a writer's critique group and started reading some passages and some chapters out of that. And they said basically that I needed a lot of work to do with it. So I had an idea for Beta already kind of in mind. So I kind of started on that. I mapped out some an outline and threw in some more characters and kind of had the idea of what I wanted already in mind, and it just took a little bit of more research to come up with this one.
So what was kind of your, inception about, with the character, you know, kind of give us a little behind the scenes of exactly, you know, who is, you know, Mallory Peterson, you know, how did you kind of build her? How did you kind of create her? You know, those types of things. And, you know, why did you decide to go ahead and, you know, write a series starring her instead of just, you know, continuing on the standalone route?
Sure. Well, years ago when I was getting involved with writing and I was writing short stories, I had a character in mind called Sam P. Peterson, and he was based out of the Quad Cities, which is Rock Island, Moline, East Moline, Davenport, Bettendorf, that area. And he was out of the East Moline Police Department, and that's where I used to live when I was a young child. And I had in mind, I'll just keep him. Well, when I moved to when we moved to Iowa, and then when I moved to the to Oskaloosa area, and I started into the martial arts, I saw all these wonderful women involved with the martial arts, and was so in awe of their talent and their skill. And then when I thought about continuing on my writing path, I thought, well, what better type of character than a martial artist? And so I switched Sam P. Peterson out for Mallory Peterson, no relation, and made her a private detective and a martial artist.
So that's something that, you know, a lot of people need to realize also, you know, authors, you know, you might love, you know, a certain subject and things like that, but you're writing about something that you know, which makes the character that much more believable, which makes it that much more interesting of a book. And that's something, like I said, a lot of authors really don't do. They might write about a subject that they like, but they don't really know a lot about it. And therefore, when they write the book, it kind of comes off a little bit on the cheesy side. And like, you know, this person doesn't really know what it's talking about. But you did something that was extremely smart, you know, doing that, you know, writing about, you know, Mallory Peterson in a field that you're very familiar with.
Sure. I started in martial arts in 1991. I went to our local club there had a 2 weeks free classes offer, And so I stopped in and enjoyed it so much, I just kept going. At the time, I was also into community theater, and the two conflicted. And so I had to make a choice whether I wanted to stick with the theater or the taekwondo, and I kept going with the taekwondo. So a lot of what Mallory uses in the story, I've already done. I've taken a lot of my training, and like you said, write what you know, and in the different scenes and the different chapters, she uses various techniques to defeat whatever bad guy she goes up against.
You know, and what's something that your fans, people about, you know, when they read the book, what's something deep about Mallory that, you know, that they might not get from the book, but something, you know, some emotional thing that she is, are you going to follow maybe like some kind of like a, more of a backstory? Are you going to do those types of things when you go forward in creation, you know, when you're creating these stories around her?
Sure. Mallory Peterson is a very emotional character. She really cherishes her students, and she gets very involved with her case, her cases, it, especially with this one in Beta, where she is after a kidnapped 8-year-old girl, and she, through her investigation and following up leads, she discovers that there is a child pornography ring. And so because she is so into instructing martial arts with kids and adults, she really cherishes her kids. So to see something like this happen to an innocent 8-year-old girl, that really gets her. It really drives her emotions. And sometimes she has to really be careful not to cross a line and, you know, kill some innocents or kill some people that probably would deserve it. But, you know, she has to still follow the law. And so I want to keep that going in future books. I want to keep that emotional high and emotional turmoil going. In Alpha, I've kind of done a little bit more backstory. Alpha was originally set in October. Beta was set in November. So when I resurrected Alpha, I had to decide what I wanted to do with it. How did I want to bring it up to date, have it in December, or did I want to say, okay, this is sort of a prequel sequel type of thing?
Right.
And so I do kind of a now and then. So the handsome guy that she meets in Beta, they get together, and it is the now part is in December, and we talk about a case that goes back to October where she discovers the body of her then boyfriend dead in front of her office building, and discovers throughout the book a lot of the secrets that he had been keeping from her.
You know, you kind of mentioned that, you know, she hits a child pornography ring in your book. And
yes.
Seeing as how, and let's just go with, you know, what's in the news right now, with the whole Penn State scandal on the child abuse and everything, and how sensitive in nature subjects like that are, when you're writing about something that is so very sensitive and so wrong, let's just say, and horrible on every level, do you get queasy when you're writing something like that? Because you have to make it believable for the part of the book. And some of the things that you put in there are just downright horrible that you have to write about.
Oh, sure. I think that was one of the major struggles that I had with this book, of how graphic did I want to be? How explicit did I want to be? And because I didn't want to turn off readers, but I wanted them to understand what was going on. So there are some sensitive scenes in there, but it does not get the details are there, but they are implied a lot of times. You know it's going on, but I don't have to describe it. And yeah, I can go back and read some of those scenes and feel very strongly. After years and years, I can still go back and reread some of those scenes and still get emotional. I can still read the humorous scenes that I put in there and still laugh at the jokes that I've made. And knowing that, I think, and I've talked with other writers about this, if you can do that, if a writer can do that and still feel emotional about the material that is written months, years later, that's good stuff.
Right. I mean, you know, that is one of the things when you're a writer, and if any, you know, writers and authors are listening out there, sometimes you have to go into the dark depths of your mind, a place that you would never go in real life, in order to capture that out there, because it's not only what you're, you know, what you have on the page, but what you're giving as yourself as a person to the audience is just as important.
Oh, sure. Sure. It's we just got done talking about writing what I know, which is the martial arts. Well,
right. You don't know child porn.
Child pornography.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, how do you write what like you said, is so absolutely horrible and wrong without going too deep into research and speaking to some of these people who do this? I didn't want to do that. I did call up the FBI and ask about it a little bit, and I had to sort of watch what I was asking because I didn't want to get on their list of people to be investigated. So in the book, I just sort of it's one of those things I had to just kind of make up and hopefully I was, I hate to say it, but hopefully I was true to the subject matter.
Okay.
In that case.
Right.
And I did what I imagined something would be like. And like I said, I didn't get too explicit with it. And I also temper those scenes, those emotional scenes, with some humorous scenes with Mallory.
So kind of how's the journey been here, you know, since the book comes out and, you know, you've been getting emails and you've been getting responses back and, you know, reviews back. You know, how's that kind of journey been for you, you know, with this book, since it is something that, you know, is brand new, you decided to try out?
Well, it's right now it's going, I think it's going pretty good. I'm just kind of getting into some of the reviews because it's an e-book. I do not have, you know, samples to send out beforehand. I didn't have an arc that I could send out to people, you know, 2 or 3 months in advance. I'm hoping that will be the case with the next book. So it's sort of wait and see till the book comes out and then start contacting reviewers. And I've gotten a couple back so far that have been really positive. And some of the people who are my some of my fans and colleagues and acquaintances and friends, they've been looking forward to the book too, and they've read it all through and given me some positive comments. And it's just it's a constant thing. The journey is constant. I don't want to stop. I want to keep getting the word out through social networking, Facebook and Twitter and some of the other sites, and as soon as these reviews start coming in, I want to start publishing those and getting those out onto the different sites that I'm on, and just kind of keep going, and hopefully I can keep it going until Alpha comes out, and then kind of start over again with that, kind of make it just continue on with that.
You know, and do you have a plan for Mallory when you sat down and decided to write these books? Did you have a plan for what you wanted to do in the future, how many you wanted to do, or are you just kind of taking all this by ear and kind of how it just goes?
Well, I did have a plan. I kind of took it off the Sue Grafton books where she goes a case a month. And I was thinking
along something along those lines. An author that we're featuring in our December magazine, we have an exclusive interview with her. So, okay, go ahead.
Oh, great. Yeah, great. And she does, with her character, she does a case a month. So she's still stuck back in 1987, 1988. I don't know if I want to continue with that. It'll depend on how things go in the future. But I don't necessarily give a year in my books. But I had originally had it, October was supposed to be Alpha, which it sort of is now. November is Beta. I'm going to skip, my plan is to skip the next couple of months and go right to February of the next year. And I'm kind of working on an outline with that and still keeping the emotional turmoil in existence with that book. There has been in Alpha and Beta, there has been a very, very subplot, just one chapter in each of the books that has a serial killer that is killing off her classmates from high school. And I want to get that taken care of in the next book. And then from there, we'll see where it goes.
So you got some definite sit-down plans for Mallory, and your fans and people will be able to see more of her in the future, which is a really good thing. And, you know, see how long, you know, you keep the train rolling on Mallory. And what other kind of standalones or things do you have going on, or are you going to encompass different things? You know, how often do you plan to keep writing? Are you going to do one a year, more than one a year? What's your goal?
Well, I've already got the first one out, which is Night Shadows. That came out earlier this year, and that was kind of an X-Files type of book with an FBI agent and a homicide cop. And I've got the sequel to that. I'm working on the sequel to that. It's completed. I just need to go back and tinker with it a little bit because it's just not quite where I want it to be. And then I want to kind of continue with that series. Right now, my goal is to – I'm working on another standalone private detective novel, and my goal is to get the first draft done by the end of this year. And I have another adventure type of thriller that is about a quarter of the way written. And I've started a romance, which don't know where that's going quite yet.
A romance?
There's all kinds of – yeah. I've kind of skipped genres. I'm not there's nothing wrong with romance. I do not want to turn off people I don't want to make any romance fans mad. It's just not my genre. I just don't enjoy those type of books. However, I've got a story that is kind of sitting in my mind, and I've kind of started the first couple chapters, and we'll see where it goes. That's one of those things that's sitting on the back burner waiting for me to get back to. There could be a romance out there one day.
You know, and we're talking here with author Stephen Brayton and about his latest book, which is called Beta. It is the first book in his newest Mallory Peterson series. So kind of last thing here, Stephen, is, you know, you're an author here. Like you said, you know, you're only on the ebook, and you're trying to get yourself out there. The book's available on Smashwords, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble. When you kind of, you know, are you kind of looking to say, hey, I want to, you know, get this thing into one of the big six publishers? Are you going to stay strictly with ebook? You know, what's kind of your end game here in the future, you know, for your writing that you would like to see it progress into?
Well, when I went with Echelon Press, which is a small press, all new authors go ebook route the first time out. And then if the sales are pretty good, then they'll consider print. With Alpha, I have gone with Oak Tree Press, and I'm waiting to hear back from them. They were going physical book right away. And I think that's where I was looking at. Right now, I'm sticking with the small press. It's a lot easier to make contacts with, and a lot easier to keep contact with, I should say.
Right.
And so we'll just kind of see from there. I know the big six are tough to break into, but if I can get my name out there and keep the brand going, keep myself in the public eye, then who knows where it could go. Yeah, I'm always hoping for something a little bit bigger and better. Kind of like when I was in Taekwondo. When I was in Taekwondo, everybody kept saying, well, you want to be a black belt, don't you? Well, you want to be a black belt. And I went, yeah, that's a goal. That's a goal far in the future. I want to be the next belt. Whatever the next belt is, that's what I wanted to be. And that's kind of why I'm looking at my writing and the books. I want whatever's next. Is it, if it's a step up, then I want that.
Right.
Do I want to be as famous as Stephen King or James Patterson? Sure, that'd be great. But that's a goal. That's a goal in the future. And you have to work up to that.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen, I want to thank you so much for joining us here today and talking about your book, Beta, the first book in Mallory Patterson Mystery Series. Wish you nothing but best of luck here with Alpha coming out also in 2012. Everybody can go to stephenbrayton.com, and they can find your book, like you said, you know, Smashwords, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, exciting times.
Yep. Also, Omnilit, O-N-N-I-L-I-T, omnilit.com.
Gotcha. So, again, thank you so much, Stephen, and enjoy yourself, and we will talk with you soon, maybe when Alpha comes out.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Take it easy, man.
Take it. All right, bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that was author Stephen Brayton. The book is Beta. You can find stephenbrayton.com. Mallory Patterson Mystery, first book, with his next one, Alpha, coming out in 2012. And, you know, Stephen brought up something that was interesting when he said the big sixes are, you know, difficult to get into. You know, when you talk about the big six, of course, you know, you're talking about, you know, Simon & Schuster, HarperCollins, Penguin, Random House, you know, Doubleday, Grand Central, those types of major publishing houses. Well, Penguin did something that was unprecedented that not one of those publishing houses has done. And I don't know if it was the pressure, you know, what they're trying to do. They launched a site called Book Country. Which when they launched out there was supposed to be for, you know, writers looking to try to find a home for their work and maybe get exposed and this and that. But now they've just mentioned that they're going the self-publishing route, and I'm just curious to know if Book Country was just a way for them to get clients or if they were literally legitimately going after authors to try to find them and try to publish them. That I do not know. What I do know is I'm very curious to see how this new venture of self-publishing is going to go with Penguin, because why would a Big Six go with a self-published? And this is a pay service. You have to pay $99 to $550 if you want to publish yourself through Penguin. Now, you might think that that is an extremely great value because it's Penguin, but I'm going to tell you right now that they're not going to be putting, you know, marketing money and things like that behind you. And I don't know what the imprint is going to be called as far as, you know, they're not going to say that you're, a Penguin author, because that's going to discount their brand severely if they do something like that, since it is technically now, they're going on this Vanity Press side of Penguin. So keep an eye out and see what it is. If anybody has, you know, contacted them about doing anything, you know, let us know, because, you know, it is new, and we're not really sure how this is all going to play out, and we're going to stay in contact and see what's going on and see if any of the other ones decide that this is a route to do. But, you know, the pay-for-publish service, I don't know. I'm just telling you, I don't, you know, it's a difficult route. It's very difficult to, you know, to do, and we're just going to have to see how they do it. And, you know, the other big news that came out here on November 15th is that, you know, Amazon has put out their new Kindle Fire, which is actually a tablet. It's not just an e-reader, but it's a tablet. And Barnes & Noble is coming out here late this month with their new tablet for the Nook. Again, another tablet, not just an e-reader, so you're able to play games and watch movies and stream things. One is $199 and one is $249. Now, I'm not going to tell you how much which one is which, but, and you probably already know anyway if you've seen other commercials, but when you have one that has exclusive content, exclusive movies, things that you can do on somebody's site that the other one doesn't have, you would think that that would be the $249 one. But instead, Amazon is undercutting Barnes & Noble, and they came out first with $199 with, like I said, exclusive content, you know, things that you're only going to be able to find on Amazon. And that is the number one reason, I think, why Amazon's, you know, tablet is probably a little bit more valuable than the Barnes & Noble Nook, because Barnes & Noble has not one exclusive agreement with anything. But like Amazon, just for instance, they have an exclusive agreement with, if you're a comic reader, with DC Comics, to have certain comics that you can only get, you know, through their Kindle Fire. And, you know, if you watch their Amazon Prime, you know, which is $79 a year, you'll get over 10,000 to 15,000 different things streaming for free. That's, you know, that's cheaper than, you know, the $8 you're going to spend at Netflix for a year, which comes out to 96 bucks. You're spending 79, and you're going to get all those things that they have for free and some exclusive content that they're doing. Barnes & Noble does not offer that. You have the app. They're both on the Android-based system, but it's a little bit different. And just from the looks of it, I would have to say that the Kindle is probably a better bet, which is why they're saying that there could be 5 million of them sold before the end of the year, which is an extremely high number. Is it going to take the pace of the iPad? Probably not, because it's not as powerful. It is only 7-inch screen, so it's a little bit different than the Barnes & Noble new Nook and the iPad. But anything that Amazon does so far, I'm behind. I always tell people, you want to know what's going on in technology in the world today, you got three companies to look for. One is Amazon, one is Apple, and one is Google. You follow those three companies and you see what's going on, even in the publishing world, with iBooks, with Google Books, now with Amazon, Kindle, and their stuff, you're not going to go wrong. So the other news we have, of course, is coming up. We've announced it to all the authors. They all know. They all know if they're on the best of 2011 list here that Suspense Magazine puts out every year. It's our most favorite issue to put together and also our most stressful one to put together, because we have to literally go through thousands and thousands of books. We've divided them up here in 11 categories. Some of them, everybody, I believe, has at least three within each category. And it's broken down like, you know, like you have professional, which includes medical and legal thrillers. You know, you have dark urban fantasy. You have the cozy mysteries. You have just the thriller category, anthologies. So they're all listed out. I believe the total is 55 winners. And there's one book that is number one overall, regardless of category. And last year was Stephen James and The Bishop. This year, you're going to find out December 5th or right around that time when we put the magazine out, and then the authors are going to do. But they're also, within the magazine, most every author that we've contacted and got a hold of has been able to answer three questions, given us a quote about how they feel. So you're able to, you're gonna see a ton of different stuff going in here, along with exclusive interviews with Sue Grafton, who's coming near the end of her Alphabet Mystery series, and Iris Johansson, who's just finished up her trilogy book, her trilogy series. So those are going to be exclusive interviews in the magazine. Also, it's going to be a huge issue coming out here in December, and it's something that you definitely don't want to miss. As for the radio show, what we got going on here for the end of the year, we're going to have two shows left here at the end of the year. We're not going to be back on again until December 10th, where we're going to have Lisa Black and MJ Rose. They're going to be right back at you December the 17th with Christopher Sanford, and coming back here is Lise Wheel. You know her, Fox News legal analyst on the Bill O'Reilly show, but she wrote a book, another one called Waking Hours, outside of her Triple Threat series, and Lise comes back on to join with us again, good friend of ours, to talk about her new endeavor with that book. So December 10th, and everything is 10 a.m. Pacific time, 1 p.m. Eastern time, Lisa Black and MJ Rose on December the 10th. And then we're going to have Christopher Sanford and Beat Wheel coming on here on December the 17th, right after. So exciting times. That's it for we have the end of the year. That, with the magazine, the radio show, it's going to be an exciting time. Thanksgiving is here next Thursday. I want to thank everybody for joining us. If you have any questions, you can email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com. We'll get back to you. Thank you to our guest here, John Weissman, that was on with his book, Kill Bin Laden, KBL. With A.J. Scuderi, that was on with her book, God's Eye. And then we just had Stephen Brayton on with his book, Beta. Check out all the authors that we have going on here. And we will see you soon. We have new Suspense publisher authors that are out on our site. So go to suspensemagazine.com to click on the published authors and see what they got going on there. And we will see you all December the 10th. Goodbye, everybody. Happy Thanksgiving.